Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Stephen, and on this week's New Statesman podcast, Anoush and I discuss the last days of Theresa May, you ask us about milkshaking, and we discuss Arsenal, UEFA, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and how money is ruining football. So, Anoush, this has obviously been a slightly fraught week in terms of recording, because it really does feel a bit like one of those kind of, like, you know, when is it safe to go into the podcast bunker? Also in her bunker, effortless segue, is Theresa May, who may or may not, by the time we come out of this, have emerged from it voluntarily. I sort of think, he said, making a virtue out of necessity, that in an odd way, the important event in terms of her future has now happened. It's the morning of polling day as we speak. Digital subscribers will, of course, be hearing this on polling day. The important event is Andrea Leadsom quitting, not even actually because of Andrea Leadsom's political position as someone with impeccable leave credentials, who would defend the government on air, who was seen as part of the kind of constructive tendency, but because ultimately it underlines that the choice is, does she stay in a government that is decaying and has bits falling off and she can't fill posts until eventually they rewrite the rules and go, the first rule of Conservative Leader Club is Theresa May can't be in it. or does she, like, come out with her hands up and go, okay, fine. Now, but it feels to me that one of the most pointless doomed acts that we engage in political journalism is speculating about what Theresa May will do, seeing as we know that she, A, doesn't really have close confidants and allies in the way that we think, and B, is really comfortable with just saying untrue things. So, you know, so maybe she has finally gone, okay, the jig's up, I'm going to walk out. I talked to one Conservative grandee yesterday who kind of said it's going to be like Waco, Texas. You know, when in sort of 1993, this cult called the Branch Davidians holed up inside, you know, a facility in Waco, Texas, refused to come out. A fire started. There was gunfire between them and the armed Texas force, the Texas Rangers or something, and 74 people died. And their basic view is Theresa May will always go for the horrendous siege rather than to be wheeled out. And that is a pretty consistent golden thread of her career. But equally, even she has a boiling point. But yeah, I just don't think it actually matters, right? She will go one way or the other.
Yeah, well, something that listeners won't have heard is when you and I had quite a similar conversation yesterday before the news came out yesterday evening, not recording, which was unknown to us. But what you said, Stephen, at that time was, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we walked out of the podcast room and heard that she'd gone. But then again, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, in 2022, we were making this same podcast about whether or not she'll still go. So I think you're right that it's silly to speculate about what she's going to do, particularly as you say, she always chooses siege over surrender, self-siege rather. So I do think you're right about that. It looks like, I mean, this, I think this period feels a little bit different. I know lots of people say it's sort of Groundhog Day and she tries the same tactic over and over again. But this was her last chance. I mean, coming up was her last chance to try and get that deal through Parliament before she said that she'll stand down. So it does feel slightly different this time, as well as being on the eve of an election where the Conservatives are going to get absolutely destroyed. So it feels like it's an opportunity for her to go in more of a way than she's had before. And it also does feel that it genuinely is her last-ditch attempt to get her deal herself through Parliament in June. So I do think that there are two actual endings coming up, whereas before it's always been not quite the end, you know, especially when they extended the deadline to October, it didn't feel like the ending was in sight at all. But these European elections do feel like a bookend now.
Yeah, and I think there is a, at every other point, there's been a sense of, oh, well, you can at least continue pretending there's some way that this deal might pass. Although I kind of think the interesting thing is, yeah, so I genuinely do think Nick Timothy's Telegraph column is must-read stuff, simply because I'm just intrigued to see how far the rabbit down the rabbit hole he will go. It can only, I think, be a matter of months before he starts referring to the 2017 election gains. I mean, you could literally write a whole essay about his use of the word jointly in his column today, in which he talks about the manifesto I jointly authored, and he's just like, I mean, okay, yeah, Ben Gummer was involved in, like, doing some of the numbers. It's true. He definitely shares an equal share of the blame for it, Nick.
But I love that jointly is his attempt at arm's length.
Yeah, it's just like...
jointly is literally joined.
It's basically one of those things where he kind of goes like, yeah, the election campaign didn't go well, campaign was too long, the message was confused, the manifesto I jointly authored's controversial social care policy did not land well. And it's one of those things where it's like, wow, like, there are so two interesting arm lengths here. One, like, jointly authored, and two, like, it's just kind of like the voters let me down by not reacting to my care policy in the way they
want. This is a classic. I just, you know, a politician is failing or a politician's advisor is failing when they're saying, it just didn't communicate well with the voters, as if there's some kind of missing person who was supposed to do that for you. It's like, you're the communicator. You're the one who's supposed to make it land,
yeah,
if you think it should. That you can always tell that that's when a policy is doomed, when they're like, well, it's not that it was a bad policy. It's just that voters didn't really understand it. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Guess whose fault that was?
Yeah, because it's just like, you're not the head of policy. You're not like, yeah, you're not, that wasn't your job. So a while ago, I was kind of just, you know, having kind of catch up with someone in the cabinet, and I went, well, look, what would actually change if she went? And they thought about it and they said, well, the big changes is any other Conservative leader would be able to say, look, we don't have a majority. And people would be able to hear that without, essentially, she's crashed the car, we're miles from home, we're going to have to walk home. They said, but no one wants to be told they need to walk faster by the person who crashed the car. And they said the next leader will have the ability to go, we just need to get Brexit passed. We cannot go to the country with Brexit unresolved. And we need to do whatever it takes to be able to, at the next election, say, now we have left the EU. The problem is, although I think that analysis was right 3 months ago, maybe even a month ago, I feel like there's been this weird process where, because mentioning the election defeat has been like kind of mentioning, you know, an awkward family row, it's almost like they've forgotten that the majority is not there and then it won't regrow, and that the majority doesn't sharply limit the available, the loss of majority doesn't sharply limit the available ways out of the mess. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really striking here, the fact that the contest essentially, so a couple of days ago, they basically went, well, if you're not going to go, we're just going to start holding this leadership election anyway around you.
Mm.
So he had kind of the first semi-hustings at the Telegraph, in which Dominic Raab was, one of his kind of set piece announcement was a 5% income tax cut every year. There were two sort of slightly unhinged things about that. One was the idea that you could pay for that solely through scrapping government departments. And it's just like, yeah, if the Whitehall merges, it's just like, yeah, you're not going to get that much revenue out of that. Good luck with that, mate. But also, just like, with what majority?
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. All of the leadership or potential leadership candidates seem to think that they're going to come in some kind of dream majority Conservative government of the past where they can pass anything they want and they can lead the country how they think it should be led. How can they do that? You know, from Boris Johnson saying he wants a no-deal Brexit, I mean, there's no majority for that, even if it will eventually be the default, to the sort of One Nation caucus saying they want to reopen sort of public spending. How are they going to do all of these things when they won't have a majority? They'll be in the situation that Theresa May is in, except even closer to probably having to call an election.
Yeah, I think it will be worse for several reasons, not least, right, that at the moment they have a hugely divided cabinet where the divisions are sort of mostly not that obvious other than on Brexit, because they can all agree that when she goes, it will be better. You know, in the financial team, you have two people who have basically never seen a tax cut they didn't like, and, you know, and whose preferred option is to deregulate everything, but they're divided over Brexit and customs. So crucially, there is no leader who they those two people could agree with, who they wouldn't either be disagreeing with on Brexit or disagreeing with on whether or not the public spending caps need to come on.
Exactly.
One of the reasons why the final Blair government struggled to pass things, even though it had a very large majority, is it there were still more sacked ministers than the overall majority. They still obviously were able to legislate fairly effectively on a number of things, but they struggled because there were so many people who felt that their careers were over and they therefore could have as many principled objections as they liked.
Mm.
Yeah, that was obviously one of the many mistakes Theresa May made in her first reshuffle, was by not only just by firing so many people, but by kind of doing a sort of Bond villain routine where she kind of sat there kind of cackling, going, you know, ha-ha, you know, let me tell you all of the things I don't like about you, Mr. Osborne.
Yeah, yeah.
Meant that you had a large caucus of people who went, you know, Nicky Morgan being the kind of most prominent example now, people went, oh, okay, well, if my career is over, then I'm not going to vote for things I don't believe in. But seeing as the next Conservative leader is going to want a fresh cabinet so they can go, look, I'm shiny and new, well, that will again mean there will be more people on the backbenches who will go, well, realistically, my career is over, so I guess it's time for me to become more rebellious, more outspoken, more difficult.
How big is that group at the moment? Is it over 30?
So what, 35 people have resigned from May's government over Brexit, essentially.
Right, okay.
I think they're in a slightly special case because all of them, in very different reasons, well, all of them other than, like, your Philip Lees and your Sam Giemers. I was speaking to one of the people who's resigned to call for a second referendum,
mm-hmm.
and someone else kind of said, oh, you know, do you think you could vote for the deal? And they were just like, no. And this was a couple of days after they'd done it. They went, I was just like, this is almost certainly the end of my ministerial career. I'd be astonished if I was not deselected. I haven't done this just to just to then vote sheepishly for the deal,
which no one else is going to vote
in 3 months' time. Why would that be a good idea? And it was one of those things where they obviously said it in a more polite way than that. But with the exception of the second referendum quitters, who know that they are crossing the Rubicon in a very different way,
yes, and their ability potentially losing their seats
to reintegrate into the tribe is a lot harder. Everyone who's quit saying this Brexit is not Brexity enough, or I can't believe we've contemplated a deal with Labour, or any of that, can at least deep down inside believe that the next leader might recall them and that their career is not over.
Yeah.
Whereas the more corrosive thing is if you'll say, I'm going to use him as an example because he's someone who we've regularly said is one of the few, you know, really effective delivery-focused ministers in the cabinet. Say David Gawk, right, who from a, like, actually getting policy done, you would absolutely want to keep, but from a cynical party management perspective, a large chunk of the Conservative parliamentary party is not going to revolt if David Gawk is sacked.
Mm.
Similarly, David Gawk will not be sitting there thinking, I wonder if I'm going to be coming back, because ultimately, you know, he's like a bloke of a certain age who is a competent administrator. There are loads of people at Minister of State level of whom that is also true. They might not be able to make the step up to cabinet level, but it's very hard to see if he were sacked how he would necessarily come back. And I think that is a very different type of sacking and a much more instability installing type.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And the question of the hour / week / depressing epoch that we are in is, well, is it okay to, well, I guess it's milkshakes. What's that about?
Is it okay to milkshake people you disagree with?
To milkshake people you disagree with politically. So milkshaking, in case you are...
Stop that pause.
in case you are.
For listeners who can't see Stephen's face, he really looks like he just wants to leave.
Happily living under a rock is a thing where people throw a milkshake over someone's head or, you know, at them, that has happened to various politicians on the nativist and far right, of whom Farage is sort of the latest example.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, Anoush, what do you think?
So I did do a piece about this, and the people who I spoke to who I found most interesting were those who were protesting against these candidates, but disagreed with using the milkshake method. So I spoke to this group of very lovely Labour activists from Totnes, which is in Devon, where Carl Benjamin, the UKIP candidate who has failed to apologise for a rape joke about Jess Phillips and has also used the N-word and other slurs and not apologised for it and says he finds racist jokes funny. He was campaigning there and they knew that he was coming, so they organised their own rival rally where other MEP candidates spoke, and they were generally just sort of chanting and making their protest against his views known. At Totnes, he also had a milkshake thrown over him by someone who was later arrested by police. And this group of activists against him disagreed with that method because they said the backlash that they received from that, even though it wasn't to do with their group, was undermining their protest because they wanted to appear peaceful and wanted to say sort of the people of Totnes reject this kind of intolerance, but they didn't want to do it in a way that they saw was not peaceful. So, you know, because they had skin in the game, I would like to at least make their argument known, because I think there's a lot of armchair opinions about this, but they actually had organised a protest and they'd sort of put efforts into it. And so I respect their opinion on it more than having my own opinion on it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it feels like one of those rows in the media that I realise I mostly tend to react strongly against whatever like absurd argument is put in front of me. So I think obviously the most obvious absurd argument I think is when people say, like, I saw someone say, oh, like, first milkshakes then acid, and it's just like, I'm sorry, like, people have thrown food at politicians quite literally since the age of the ancient Romans. Now, as with let oxygen be a disinfectant, let give these things a platform and scrutiny will defeat them, the historical suggestion is that scrutiny is not a particularly effective device for halting the rise of the anti-democratic extremes, right? That is fine. You can continue to believe that if you want, but you are at this point the equivalent of someone saying that leeches will cure leprosy, right? There is a huge amount of historical evidence that you're wrong.
Yeah.
Similarly, there is a huge amount of historical evidence that throwing food at politicians is not an effective form of protest. However, there is also a huge and overwhelming body of evidence that throwing food at politicians is a perfectly normal form of protest, and b, that the people who do it do not gradually radicalize into acts of harmful violence against politicians. And I do think, in an odd way, I completely agree that people who are organizing protests saying actually we didn't like it, I think fine, you have to kind of take them. I think, to me at least, that my sort of feeling about it is I think I am open to a range of takes on it, but the argument, one, that the original incident wasn't a response to actual violence already, and also I just think that the interesting political change is not the protest itself, which, although a milkshake is new, and I guess the advantage of a milkshake is you can't even accidentally harm someone in a way you notionally could with an egg or a rotten tomato, is that the media ecosystem, right? So I was, thinking about this in the context of the Telegraph, which obviously where I started out in journalism as, a peon on the comment desk. We would not have, when Ed Miliband was egged in 2014, written anything about it other than like here's a quirky history of egg throwing. Not because of, him being on the left and it being a right-wing paper, but just because there wasn't that kind of sort of, like, need for outrage. And I think the fact that you have, like, kind of, like, five or six Telegraph pieces on, like, what milkshaking says about the state of the left, that well-known cohesive and agree and always breaking out in fits of agreement entity, I think is actually a much more interesting media trend.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back at when Peter Mandelson, I think in 2009 or a really long time ago, had some dyed green custard thrown at him right in his face, not even a metre away from him by a green rights protester. You know, they were making puns about it. He was laughing about it. Gordon Brown was laughing about it when he made a statement about it. I think the pun was something to do with, you know, wearing the green cause on his shoulders or something like that. And you're absolutely right. I'm sure there were no articles back then about what this says about environmental campaigning gone too far or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it's the same, you know, with other incidences of this kind of thing throughout history. Like, you know, Rupert Murdoch had that foam custard pie as well.
Yeah, no one went, oh, what this says about Leveson.
What this says about the anti-Murdoch. But, you know, yes, that says a lot about how journalism has changed. But I also do think that perhaps there is more hand-wringing because the norms have fallen away slightly in the past few years. So I do understand why people are more sensitive to the idea of attacking politicians physically, which is what it is, in this time when we've had a sitting MP killed.
Yeah, and I think that is the thing. The crucial difference is that in 2001, you know, when Prescott, you know, punched the guy, one of the reasons why it's funny is if someone said, oh, what if he had been like a serious figure who was going to do people's harm, the answer would have been like, oh, but he wasn't. Now, obviously, the answer to someone who milks someone is still like, they're not. And I think we're failing as moral arbiters in the press. And indeed, I think anyone who tweets something like, you know, if you start with milkshakes, eventually someone will throw acid. It's just like, no, like there is an absolute and obvious moral difference between throwing a McDonald's milkshake over someone and throwing acid on them. You can think that milkshake is wrong, but if you cannot understand the really obvious moral difference there, and we as a, you know, an industry cannot, you know, be loud and aware of that difference, like, I just find that deeply troubling. But of course, as you say, there is this big difference that the question of how did that person clear the perimeter has become a lively one, and that does make it a very different moment. So, Anoush, in a flagrant abuse of power, in a terrifying view into the world after Helen leaves for the Atlantic, I'm going to talk about Arsenal's game with Chelsea in the UEFA Cup/Europa League final, which you wrote a very good, even if you don't follow football, that's indeed you don't, piece about Henrik Mkhitaryan not being allowed to play. So you want to talk a bit about what's happened, you know, for non-sporting.
Yeah, I'm so delighted that our interests have collided for this podcast. Yeah, so Mkhitaryan, who is a midfielder and Armenian for Arsenal, has decided that he won't be going to the final, which is in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. And that's because he and his family and presumably the club too feel that his safety has not been guaranteed in that country. So Azerbaijan and Armenia have essentially been at war. They don't have diplomatic relations because of this territory in Azerbaijan called Nagorno-Karabakh, which is historically ethnic Armenian, and it's 95% Armenian. They have the same currency as Armenia. They see themselves de facto as an Armenian republic, but it's in Azerbaijan, and in the eyes of international law, it's part of Azerbaijan. So it's a sort of disputed territory, and it's been in conflict, you know, for a while. I mean, lots of different ethnic minorities have lived there in peace together over history, but there have been skirmishes, and then in the 80s during the Soviet Union, as empires often do, it sort of used it as a divide and rule tactic to stir up tensions between the two countries which border one another. And so that's the context. And any Armenian, including me, who has a British passport and was born in London, is not able to visit Azerbaijan because of that. So anyone with an IAN or YAN at the end of their surname, which is all Armenian surnames pretty much, but also lots of people who aren't Armenian have that at the end of their surname. So one example is the Cornish surname Trevelyan. So lots of fans have been denied visas to go to this final, which has also stirred up a lot of outrage against UEFA.
Yeah, it kind of is, you know, don't worry, people who don't like football, this is the segue as well. It is kind of, in microcosm, you know, the kind of football's, and indeed the world's, grim pact with money and the influence of essentially oil money in this instance, right? In the, why has Arsenal been completely lacking in, you know, in essentially any basic solidarity with our player? Because if we win the UEFA Cup, it comes with a qualification into the Champions League, which has huge financial implications. Why has UEFA allowed this tournament to be held in a country where a member of another UEFA member be guaranteed to go? Because although Azerbaijan is also not a footballing power, it is a country which spends a great deal of money whitewashing its reputation overseas. which means that they are allowed to host a final, despite the fact that, you know, only 6,000 Arsenal fans will be able to go, only 6,000 Chelsea fans will be able to go. You know, these are two of the, you know, the biggest clubs in the world, and also the two biggest clubs in London, and they always will be, no matter what happens later on in June. And, you know, why is that being tolerated by the two clubs? Yeah, because of the huge revenue for the involved in the Champions League, particularly for Arsenal, who otherwise will not qualify for it. Also, as you kind of allude to, right, if Mkhitaryan were, you know, a Cristiano Ronaldo figure, this would not be happening. And actually, the reason why Arsenal is so relaxed about it, and I do think it is pretty shameful on the fans, and I include myself in this, right, then I'm annoyed in the abstract, but I'm a lot less annoyed than I would be if I thought Mkhitaryan was someone who, when I saw his name on the starting lineup, I didn't go, oh, are we starting him again?
How dare you?
I'm sorry. Yeah, it is kind of a fascinating sort of example of it. And I do think, you know, to kind of segue back to the main topic of the podcast, in terms of the argument that Labour is trying to prosecute, particularly in small towns where it has a kind of wider sort of cultural halitosis with some of those voters, I do genuinely think that, particularly men, that football and what is likely to happen to it as a result of money, even more so over the coming years, is potentially a really interesting way that they can pivot into a wider critique of global capitalism, right? We've got a league where essentially an oil-rich state can again buy a hugely respected coach, admittedly someone who's never had to work someone with a budget, but let's just let that minor detail slide. You know, can buy, you know, hugely good players in every position. We'll be able to do so again next year. And even when a Liverpool side, you know, having, you know, through a kind of financial fair play compliant model, through self-sustain, you know, yeah, or indeed, you know, as much as I hate to say anything nice about them, Spurs, a club who are well run, who are, you know, living within their means, it feels almost inconceivable to see how Spurs could bridge the gap between themselves and City, a lot less conceivable than the gap between Arsenal and Spurs, where all we would have needed to do was beat one of Brighton or Crystal Palace at home. I'm still bitter about it. Money is, I think, going to drain the competitiveness out of the sport even further. There's new changes to the Champions League where essentially clubs with a big history like Arsenal will be able to probably find a way into the Champions League final, no matter how disappointing our home form continues to be. I think probably will also rob it of some of its energy as a competition. And I think it is maybe a moment when, you know, four political parties. You saw actually with the Greens going, look at the carbon footprint here, a way to go, look, there's, you know, there's something wrong with the state of football. Maybe there's something wrong with the state of society, our economic model.
Yeah, it just smells bad, doesn't it? And it's alienating. Yeah. I think, yeah, for fans who would have had to fly to Baku to watch that final, I mean, that's a long way away. It's in a country that doesn't have a sort of big footballing heritage. And it's two English clubs as well. And now there's another, you know, moral excuse not to play the match there. As you say, they can't forfeit it or boycott it for financial reasons. That's just, it just feels like it's putting money over the fans, but also the players as well. And if you're a fan of your local, I agree, like in smaller towns and maybe in lower league football clubs, if you're, you know, if you see that your players being messed about by the sort of footballing powers that be, then that feels alienating, and it just, you know, that something's not right there. So I do think it is ripe territory for a political party to go and say, look, you know, there's something rotten in the state of football, but also it's to do with capitalism. Did Labour not have a policy to have fans on boards?
They do actually have some quite developed stuff on. The Lib Dems and I think the Greens now have a policy on safe standing. Labour's policy is currently to look at it, but they do have some sort of quite developed stuff on fan voice as well. But yeah, so it is an interesting. So yeah, we've solved,
brought it back round.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Anoush Shekellian. It's recorded at the moment by me, which is why our producer Nick Hilton deserves extra thanks for rescuing it from my various blunders. If you've enjoyed the New Statesman podcast, do leave a review on iTunes or subscribe to get it earlier and minus the various adverts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.